still in Samuel, in 2 Samuel now. Last week, something weird happened. We started chapter 3 and didn't finish it. Instead of, you know, starting chapter 3 and ending in chapter 5.
So.
We've done that a few times, yeah. I'll just leave that up there as a comment from last time. One of the ways we become better readers of Scripture is by reading Scripture. And reading more of it. And sometimes, right, some of us have Bibles that have lots of cross-references in the margin. I hate those. I find them distracting. Because I rarely actually go look up those cross-references. And when I do, they're the least interesting. Actually, right? Like there's a, this word is also used in that passage, and that's not particularly interesting to me. What would be more helpful is if we had something that told us as we go through, hey, make sure you read Deuteronomy 17 while we're watching the development of the kingship in Israel, right? Because way back in Deuteronomy, the Lord anticipates that Israel will have a king and gives some, right, lays down some laws for what that is going to look like, what they should expect, what the king should and should not do. So why don't we actually, since that came up last week, it's come up a time or two before, why don't we actually turn and read Deuteronomy 17 and then we'll come back to 2 Samuel 3. And we should read all of Deuteronomy 17. We should read all of Deuteronomy, for that matter. But the section concerning Israel's king starts at verse 14. And following. It's on page 226 of my Bible. That probably doesn't help you. So Moses there says, when you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law, approved by the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right hand or to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. So this tells us some things the king should not do and some things the king should do. And it also comments on the fact that Israel will want a king and that the Lord will allow a king within certain parameters. So what are some things the king should not do? Yeah. Yeah, so don't collect horses or wives, especially horses from Egypt. Yeah, gold and silver. Summarize that as well. Sorry? Yeah, don't collect any of these things. And what should they do? Yeah. Write, like not just read it, not just talk to the priests about it, but actually write out for themselves under the supervision of the priests a copy of the law for their own continued and perpetual devotion. That they may not depart from it. This is very, very clearly not even in the background anymore. It's in the foreground as we read about Solomon. And far earlier than we anticipate, right? We get to 1 Kings 11, and the narrator is not even playing with us anymore. He will just quote directly from Deuteronomy 17, except instead of saying the king should not do this, he'll say Solomon did this. But far earlier in 1 Kings, from the first moments we meet Solomon, some of these things start to show up, along with other details, like he spends so long building the temple. And then a few verses later, he spends twice as long building his own palace and a house for his wife. Right? That should send alarm bells, right? One of them is for the royal family, and one of them is for the entire nation to come and worship the Lord together. Right? But this is also in the background far earlier, as we are watching Saul and thinking about what kind of king is Saul. Saul is the one that they ask for, right? That's mentioned in these first few verses. So how does he compare to this? And then now as we're transitioning and David is becoming king, at least over Judah, and here in a while over Israel as well, how does David fit this mold? And the narrator is going to be much more subtle than he is by the time we get to Solomon. But there are still things that should make us scratch our heads, even as we're watching David. Enough to make you think, right? We leave Saul thinking, David is the king we need. And I think if we're paying attention, we'll decide very quickly, David is not the king we need. David is more of what we need than Saul was, perhaps. But also enough, there's enough lacking in David's execution of the office of a king that it leaves us looking for someone else who we're not going to see for a while. Okay, so back to 2 Samuel chapter 3.
Tony?
Yes.
Two of those three of them don't collect. Mm-hmm. They give a reason for why not.
Yes.
Collecting the horses from Egypt because that may be back to Egypt. Mm-hmm. Wives, because they're going to turn his heart away.
Mm-hmm.
They don't say anything about the wealth.
Yeah, the that silver and gold is just.
That implied.
I think there is an implication. Yeah, because the horses, it's don't go back to Egypt. I told you, never go back that way. Wives, they will turn away the king's heart and don't collect silver and gold. And then it just keeps going. Yeah. So is the implication that perhaps in so doing, the king would be turning his heart away from the Lord toward material wealth? Maybe so. Maybe so. And wealth is connected with power as well. And if we think about Saul, that's one thing we saw with Saul. Not a collecting of silver and gold, but a concern for maintaining a grip on what power he had. And that's where he ran afoul of the Lord. Right? Those are the moments where he shows where his heart is. Is where submitting to God's instructions would mean letting go or loosening his grip on power. So, I suspect that's where the connection is. But we can watch for that. When it comes to the four in the narrative, what things are attached to it? Since in Deuteronomy it's not spelled out for us. That's a good question. Yeah. It also leaves us with, well, How many horses is too many horses? That's the question we always ask, right? It's okay, we know we're not supposed to have too many of something, but what's the number, right? I want a threshold. And we would never quite put it this way, but in our mind, right, like, if I know I'm not supposed to have too many, so is 20 too many? Because if so, I want 19. Right? And maybe there are certain circumstances that I can arrange that make 20 okay. And so I can have my 20. But it's not 21. And John, down the road, he has 21. So I'm not John. Right? But this is going to come up right away, actually, in 2 Samuel 3. Right? Because how many wives is too many wives? Right? We know Solomon has too many wives. I don't think anybody would disagree that Solomon has too many wives. What about David? Right? Because as we jump back into 2 Samuel 3, he's got more than one. He's got more than two. He's got more than three. So how many is too many? So I know we read part of this last week, but let's just start again from the beginning of the chapter, 2 Samuel 3. And I'll read that for us. There was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew stronger and stronger while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. And sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam of Jezreel. There's a wife. And his second, Kileab of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. There's a second wife. The third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. There's a third wife. And the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. There's a fourth. And the fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital. And the sixth, Ithream of Eglah, David's wife. These were born to David in Hebron. So we've got six wives named there. Yeah, some of you, like, you're looking at me and your eyes are this big. For us, this is definitely, that's way too many. He would have been in trouble with the law a long time ago, right? All right. And we talked about that a little bit last week, right? Sometimes a large family is a sign of blessing. Almost always, even when it's a sign of blessing, it's also an indication that we should expect strife. So we'll see how that develops in David's household. Especially when some of them have royal connections. Okay.
Was having multiple wives God's original intent, or did something change along the way? Admitting this, what? Somewhere along the scriptures, that is correct.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. So what about multiple wives? Is this part of God's design that as a culture, for some reason, we've just rejected, and perhaps wrongly so? Is this something that God allowed or designed and then later decided that's a bad idea? Like God changed his mind? Is it something that was not God's intention, but that he winked at for some time and doesn't any longer? I think there are two places we look that help us answer that. One is in the Garden of Eden, right? We have Adam and Eve. We don't have Adam and Eve and Eva and Evie and Evelyn. And Adam is provided with one wife, and this human couple is given the commission to be fruitful and multiply and to exercise authority over God's creation. And it seems like if part of God's original intent was to have multiple wives, we would see that at the beginning. And then we also have what Jesus mentions in the New Testament, although it's from the Old, right? Going back to Genesis about how a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And the description there is of two becoming one flesh, not three becoming one flesh, or two becoming one flesh, and then again becoming one flesh later. And so it seems difficult to understand that imagery in terms of multiple spouses. So. There do seem to be several places where, for whatever reason, God allows certain of the patriarchs, certain of the rulers, to have multiple wives. And it also seems to never end well. He seems to also allow them to enjoy the consequences of the strife that brings into the household.
You say that there's some precedent for that type of thing. God tolerating things and later suggesting it or giving more revelation. Mm-hmm. The divorce, I mean, the discussion of the marriage by Jesus also in that same mental context includes the discussion of divorce. They ask him why then did Moses give a certificate of divorce? And Jesus' answer is that it was not because of God's will, it was because of the hardness of their hearts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. God doesn't shut me all my sin at once, because if he did, I'd probably fold up into a little tumbleweed and blow away. But it's a little bit at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's how he deals with his corporately as well, and the people of God throughout the history.
Yeah, a gradual revealing of us to our sin. And confronting it head on, but not without leaving hints to us even earlier.
Yeah.
This is a bad idea. This doesn't work out well. All right. So I think we're at verse 6. Father, sorry, go ahead. Oh, yes, thank you, Mike. While there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, and Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone in to my father's concubine?" Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David. And yet you charge me today with a fault concerning a woman. God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba." And Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. We spoke last week about how what is wrapped up in that accusation is a charge of Abner attempting to take over and appropriate to himself the kingship. That's what is implied in taking the concubine of the former king. And that's what Ishbosheth is accusing him of, not just some kind of sexual impropriety, but political maneuvering, right? He sees Abner becoming strong in Israel, and he's suspicious like his father. And there develops here this relationship between Ishbosheth and Abner that reminds us of the relationship between Saul and David, and also seems to have this overtone of the innocence of the captain of the armies in the face of the suspicion of the king. So. "And Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, 'To whom does the land belong? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all Israel to you.' And he said, 'Good, I will make a covenant with you. But one thing I require of you, that is, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face.' Then David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me my wife, Michal, for whom I paid the bridal price of 100 foreskins of the Philistines." And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, Paltiel, the son of Laish. But her husband went with her, weeping after her, all the way to Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, "Go, return." And he returned. And Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, "For some time past, you have been seeking David as king over you. Now then, bring it about. For the Lord has promised David, saying, 'By the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies.'" Abner also spoke to Benjamin. And then Abner went to tell David at Hebron all that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin thought good to do. When Abner came with 20 men to David at Hebron, David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, "I will arise and go and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires." So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. Just then, the servants of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him came, it was told Joab, "Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he has let him go, and he has gone in peace." Then Joab went to the king and said, "What have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why is it that you have sent him away so that he is gone? You know that Abner the son of Ner came to deceive you, and to know your going out and your coming in, and to know all that you are doing." When Joab came out from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the cistern of Sirah. But David did not know about it. And when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the midst of the gate to speak with him privately, and there he struck him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Azahel, his brother. Afterward, when David heard of it, he said, "I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house, and may the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge, or who is leprous, or who holds a spindle, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks bread." So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner, because he had put their brother Azahel to death in the battle at Gibeon. Then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, "Tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and mourn before Abner." And King David followed the bier, and they buried Abner at Hebron. And the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king lamented for Abner, saying, "Should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen." And all the people wept again over him. Then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was yet day. But David swore, saying, "God do so to me and more also, if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down." And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as everything the king did pleased all the people. So all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner the son of Ner. And the king said to his servants, "Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I was gentle today, though anointed king. These men, the sons of Zeruiah, are more severe than I. The Lord will repay the evildoer according to his wickedness." What do we make of that? We know something from the beginning, that the people around David and the people who get this news don't know. And what is that? What is it that we as readers know, because the narrator tells us, that other people, the people in this story, only find out as they watch what unfolds?
Joab's got a grudge,
and David has no part of it. David has no part of it. Right? The narrator tells us very clearly at the end of verse 26, right, when Joab goes after Abner, David did not know about it. Because imagine being in Israel or being in Benjamin as this unfolds, right? Abner's got a spat with Ishbosheth. That probably becomes known on some level. Abner goes with David to meet with David, and then Abner doesn't make it back alive, right? And that's the news that's spread. That does not look good for David, right? That doesn't look good for the things that David has been trying to arrange. But we know as readers that David has no part in this. And then as it continues to unfold, right? What does Joab tell David is the reason he shouldn't have sent Abner away? He's here to spy things out, right? An accusation we've heard before, right? It's the accusation that Joseph levels against his brothers in Genesis. Right? It's a common thing, a fear of spies coming in to see the weakness of the land. It's something Israelites do in Joshua, right? And earlier in Numbers. So it's a reasonable suspicion for Joab to have. But it's not the reason that Joab wants to get him, is it? And that's, again, something the narrator makes very clear for us in verse 30. Right? Because we could hear that conversation between Joab and David. We'd be like, well, that's a reasonable suspicion to have. Right? Maybe he is. Maybe this is Abner maneuvering for his own sake. But we know, both because of the earlier story and because the narrator expressly tells us, right, that the reason Joab did this, and we find out that Abishai was also involved, that the reason for this was because Abner was the one who killed Azahel in the battle at Gibeon. Those are useful things to watch as you read, and it explains part of David's seemingly over-the-top reaction to everything. It's because David knows that the Israelites don't get the narrator's perspective, right? The Israelites hear the events that happened, and they don't get to see into David's thoughts. They don't get to see into Joab's thoughts. And so David knows that his own people in Judah need to know that he disagrees with this. He was not suspicious of Abner, that they're right, that there is reason to have goodwill toward Israel and Benjamin as they approach Judah here. And he also knows that the people of Israel and the people of Benjamin need to know that David disapproves of what's happened, that David has no part in this, that they can trust David to deal with them in good faith as they come to him and try and negotiate a transition of power and David taking over the kingship. And it also undercuts anything Ishbosheth might have been able to do in throwing suspicion on David at this point. Because as much as Ishbosheth distrusted Abner, right, this could have played out very well politically for Ishbosheth. It's like, look what happened when Abner went and spoke to him. Right? This is how David deals with people, and no, we should not entrust ourselves to him. What else do we see in the passage? Yeah. So Saul's daughter, Michal, what's going on there, right? Because after David has to go into hiding, Saul takes his daughter, Michal, who is married to David, right, who had helped David escape. He takes her because she didn't go with David into hiding. Saul takes her and gives her to this other fellow as a wife. Poor Michal was just a pawn in all of this political maneuvering on Saul's part. And now, what did she hear? David wants her back. Why does David want her back? That's a big question. The narrator doesn't tell us, and David doesn't say. Right? Because there's so much at stake in that request. Right? For Abner, it gives him cover. Right? It gives him a reason to come and meet with David that is not going to raise suspicion with Ish-bosheth. Although, I wonder, why on earth would Ish-bosheth grant this request? Is he that afraid of David? Because this is Saul's daughter. Right? It's Ish-bosheth's aunt, but it's Saul's daughter. So it connects David to the house of Saul and to a potential claim for the throne of Israel for him to have Saul's daughter back. As readers, it also leaves us wondering, is there a continuing hope, a glimmer of a possibility of a dynasty for the house of Saul if Michael is back in David's household and potentially going to bear him children? Which is interesting because we already have, six sons mentioned at the beginning of the chapter. But we also know from earlier in Samuel that Saul loves Michael. David loves Michael, and Michael loves David. So all these years of separation, this other marriage that's taken place in between, that's a further complication. So, and I think it's wonderful, actually, how the text just doesn't answer any of that. It raises all of that and doesn't answer any of it, which I think has a way of drawing us in to what's going on and also rewards us for paying attention as we read the text. It's one of those moments where it just leaves us going, once again, right, how can anybody imagine that this literature is boring? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, there's another possibility here as well, wrapped up in this exchange with Ish-bosheth, that might explain Ish-bosheth's granting of the request is not just fear of David, but the possibility of establishing ties in such a way that it helps maintain peace between Israel and Judah. Like perhaps from Ish-bosheth's side, there's no thought of releasing his hold over Israel. He's going to continue. But if it's his aunt, right, sister, who's given to David, then that strengthens ties between Israel and Judah, helps lessen the likelihood of war, and also perhaps further down the line would give Ish-bosheth a claim on Judah if there's trouble in the lines of succession in Judah. So much political maneuvering from both sides, in the midst of all of that. So, there's a sweet and really sad moment in the midst of all of that. Just an encouragement to learn Hebrew, if you ever get the opportunity. The name of the place where the husband comes, following Michal all the way until Abner stops him and makes him go back, Bahurim, means weeping. It's the place of weeping. There are just little word plays like that all through the passages. That to have a footnote that tells you that is one thing, but to see that for yourself as you're reading is so rewarding. So I would greatly encourage you, right, not to distrust your English translation or to devalue it, but if you ever get the opportunity to also learn Hebrew, it is difficult, but it is also very, very rewarding. So. All right. There's another dark note in this chapter that we've seen glimpses of already. I think it was Rose asked a couple weeks ago about this raid that Joab goes on in Benjamin that David seems to know nothing about, right? How is it that Joab has such a free hand? And Joab does here as well, right? Joab goes after Abner, and we're clearly told by the narrator that David had nothing to do with this. David did not approve of it. But when we come to the end of the chapter, what does David do about it?
He just makes Joab do what's probably humiliating for Joab. Don't say, well, it's really not warning.
Yeah. It's like, you're going to be sad whether you like it or not. Right? So Joab has to go to the funeral and pretend like he's mourning. And there is certainly some humiliation to that. And he speaks about how he is gracious, right? And he is gentle. But these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are not. But what does he do to curb that? What does he do to restrain it? What does he do to try and get a handle on his right-hand man? Absolutely nothing. How do you think that is going to develop over time? Yeah, not good. Rose?
Actually, I read it and I see a little more than that. It's not just him not restraining, but him saying, that's not me. So it's almost acknowledging publicly he's got a free hand.
Yeah, in what he says, and by merely saying things, David effectively lets the nation know that he is unable to control Joab. Which I suppose can also serve David, right? If Joab goes and does something that David wanted him to do, that later it's politically wise and beneficial to deny. He's given himself plausible deniability there. But he's also let Judah and probably a much wider and probably international public know that he is unable. Joab didn't take Abner in battle. Joab didn't pursue Abner as a kinsman redeemer, right? And he couldn't have justly anyway, because his brother was killed in battle, not through manslaughter or murder.
But it makes you wonder. So the law also said you need two or more witnesses. Mm-hmm. If you're going to execute someone for murder, apparently this happened privately between Joab and Abner.
Although Abishai is also there.
Oh, yeah.
Which we find out later. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it makes you wonder how did David hear of this? Because I'm sure Abishai didn't go.
Yeah.
Maybe they were gloating about it, but
yeah, how does David come to know? Why does David fail to do something about it? And is this also something that should raise flags for us? Is this David failing to apply the law that he should be writing out his own copy of? Rose.
I feel like it's a reminder of the cultural differences also, because I feel like if something, a national figure from a different country were assassinated by someone in power in our government, and Biden was like, oh, I have no control over that, we would immediately be saying, wait a minute, you're supposed to be reigning in your people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they see that here too. I think that's part of the narrator's portrayal of David, is showing, before he even takes the throne of Israel, showing cracks in his ability to reign over a united kingdom. So, which is interesting because we have not yet even quite gotten to the point where in the narrative we realize the hopes that are set up, the expectations that we have coming out of 1 Samuel. We've not quite yet realized that hope that we know is coming of David reigning over a united Israel. And before we have yet reached that point, we're already seeing weaknesses in David's ability to do that. We're already seeing things that show us that David might be better than Saul. He might be worse than Saul. Or he might simply be no better than Saul. Just a different flavor of problems. So. Good. It'll all get better in chapter 4. Right? We'll all get better in chapter 4. So let's put chapter 4 off till next week. But please do read it between now and then. We'll see something very similar to something we saw a couple of chapters earlier. Thank you.
Thank you.